Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast. I'm Dave Etler. In 2009, the population of the United States included 13% that were born in a foreign country. Many of these people also have first-generation children who, while they may be citizens of the U.S., are also influenced by the culture of their parents. Cultural psychiatry seeks to place mental illness in the context of the sufferer's culture, of the patient's culture, I guess we could say. And it also deals with the challenges of delivering mental health services to patients with non-mainstream cultural identities. Ethnicity, though, is only one type of culture. There are many cultures and subcultures, all of which influence a patient's understanding, acceptance of, compliance with, and access to treatment. So our guest today is Dr. Hendry Tan. He's the medical director of the Transcultural Wellness Center and director of education at UC Davis School of Medicine, Center for Reducing Health Disparities. Dr. Tan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us today is Lisa Weir. Thanks for coming, Lisa.
Anytime.
So I just gave a super brief overview of the discipline of cultural psychiatry. So I wonder if you can tell us more about the facets of your specialty, Dr. Tan. What are the kinds of issues that psychiatrists and their patients deal with that can be helped by an understanding of the patient's culture?
Well, I would say that the majority of issues that psychiatrists or doctors in general have with their patients can be improved with an understanding of culture. So if you look at, the different, phases of a doctor's interaction with a patient. So even when the patient walks into the door of the office, right, even before that, the doctor sees the patient. Now, if you're from a culture where you don't know how to speak English very well, you walk into that office. All the signs are in English. Maybe you have to use a bathroom. You don't know where the bathroom is at. You try to ask the reception, and they're trying their best to understand you, but you can't get even those basic needs met. Now, granted, a lot of people, even who are immigrants, know some basic English. You can sort of imagine the vulnerability that a patient feels when going to a doctor's office already, when this is compounded by a sense of, you know what, maybe I don't belong here. Maybe they're not expecting me here. Maybe they're not really, maybe I won't be able to communicate my concerns. So at the very beginning, even before going to a doctor's office, culture is relevant. And so what can a practice do? Well, having magazines, having pictures that speak to the population that they serve. If I look into, I'm Asian American. If I look into my doctor's office and I don't see anybody that represents the culture that I share, am I going to feel welcome or am I going to have some concerns? I might have some concerns if I've had experiences of isolation in the past, and a lot of patients with chronic illness, like mental health conditions, have had episodes or experiences of being stigmatized. So that's number one. Let's say now they go into their doctor's office and they meet their doctor for the first time. I think the number one question that patients have for their doctors is, does my doctor understand me? Does he or she understand where I'm coming from? And that is in a lot of ways, that's a cultural question. Irregardless of which culture one comes from, whether it's rural Idaho, in Iowa City, or if it's in California where I'm coming from, the question remains a fairly universal question. Does my doctor understand me? That may have to do with, my beliefs around medicine and health. So does my doctor know that I'm taking a remedy that my grandmother passed down to me? And do I feel comfortable asking about or telling my doctor about that? Will my doctor ask? I'm going to be looking out for those things to gauge whether or not I can connect with this doctor. So a doctor that is familiar with the cultures that that walk through the door is going to have a better chance at engaging the patient. But even if the doctor's not familiar, if they're open to the idea that not all patients share their own, our system of medicine, that can be welcoming. So if I ask, if a doctor asks the patient, are there things outside of medications that you use that you feel really helps promote your healing? That question is very much a cultural question that really reaches back into the patient's tradition, the patient's history, patient's culture and family. Treatment as well, can be very, very much culturally influenced. So, you know, the example of, you know, a patient that comes in with traditions that are passed down from generation to generation, does the doctor have a sense of how their medications will impact this patient who has this idea of how healing works? And again, you know, every patient has a unique culture that's sort of a kaleidoscope of the various elements of culture, whether that is regional culture, you know, a rural person in Iowa versus a urban person in New York, regional culture, family culture. You know, families develop their own culture over time and pass down from one generation to the next. The culture of economics, you know, people in the upper class think differently about health than people who struggle with poverty. So those factors can be very important in all aspects of healthcare. It's the kaleidoscope of culture that I think the physician is challenged to try to understand, but cultural psychiatry provides a framework for how to understand that, how to engage in discovering that with your patient.
And it sounds like one of the challenges is that culture is largely invisible to, or that, you know, one's own culture is largely invisible to you. It's just how you are, how you grew up. And you may not even think about it unless you're prompted to in some way.
Right. And I think that you're right. That is a challenge. Actually, Dr. Potash from, who's the chair of psychiatry here, and I were having a discussion about that, and he likened culture to the air that we breathe. And I think that's a wonderful metaphor that really describes this sense of everybody having a culture, but we all, because it's so intrinsic to who we are and how we live, that it's just part of the air that we breathe. We take it for granted until we don't have any air, until there's a difference in the context that makes us recognize that, oh, my culture is different, or my culture, you know, I have to be mindful of someone else's culture. So just as a person, you know, goes underwater and recognizes that, oh boy, I need to breathe. A person, you know, if we were to go to another country and experience their culture, it helps us to recognize our own culture. And so, you know, fortunately in America, we are very much a pluralistic society, so that every interaction that we have is a potential for us to recognize our own culture and the culture of the other person.
Another challenge that I always think about is, so you do maybe have someone who comes to you from a different culture. I guess you could argue maybe everyone comes to you from a different culture. We all have different experiences. How do you recognize that they may have that and be open to that without making assumptions that they have any specific culture?
Yes. Well, fortunately, medicine already has a way of doing that. We just need to recognize its role in helping us to understand the cultural person. So, you know, medical students are trained on how to take a social history. And some of the elements of a social history that I think are really important in understanding culture is simple question of where were you born and how did you come here? So there you're talking about immigration, whether it's immigrating from, you know, from Asia to America, or immigrating from an urban setting to a rural setting, and asking them what was it like to relocate here. That's a great way for them, again, to sort of compare and contrast one cultural context to another. Another question that I like to ask is, who are the important people in your life? We tend to learn and develop our own culture based on the meaningful relationships. So if a person were to say, you know, the people that I really enjoy hanging out with are football fans, then I will have a sense, and this is just a sense, it's not a conclusion, I'll have a sense that perhaps football is really important to this person. And then I might want to explore things like exercise with this person, because I might have a sense that, you know, football being important, I wonder if exercise is important. And that might get into, you know, how did you come to enjoy football? And the person might talk about, well, this came from my family, my father. So what I'm doing there is I'm starting to flesh out a specific dimension of culture, which is a group affiliation. I think part of in this discussion, we also have to think about what culture is. And how I define culture, and a lot of our colleagues in cultural psychiatry, is it's a set of values. It's a way of looking at things. It's a set of norms. What's normal behavior? What's abnormal behavior? It's a way of looking at the world that is shared by a group of people, okay? So it's important, this idea of a group of people, because, again, it's really, culture is transmitted through relationships. And so so based on that definition, culture can be the faith group that you you belong to. It can be the ethnic culture that you belong to. It can be the medical culture. And a subset of that could be the culture of medical students. You know, Lisa, you were talking about the importance of collaboration and sharing of resources as a first-year medical student. That is a value that you share in a group of individuals, you know, who are medical students. And that's part of the culture that you have here, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
I think you made a really good point of getting a sense and not coming to a conclusion. It's really easy, especially I think in the medical profession, when we seem to be constantly pressed for time, to jump to those conclusions and, you know, think because you're from X, maybe you believe this, without being like, well, maybe they do, maybe they don't, to try to parse that out.
Once you've made a conclusion, you've closed off other areas of investigation, other areas of thought.
And that is probably one of a significant danger of learning about culture is the potential for stereotyping. So Jerry Ann Galante, who's a medical anthropologist in University of California at Los Angeles, talks about the difference between generalization and stereotyping. So you can take a bit of cultural knowledge, and what I like to use, because it's personal to my culture, is this notion that a lot of Asian Americans don't feel so comfortable with sustained eye contact, okay? And if you look at the older text on Asian Americans, especially Asian immigrants, you might find that as a cultural hint. Now, I can take that
as... All I can think about right now is looking at you.
You're getting me nervous. So I can take that bit of cultural group information and I can apply it to a patient in a stereotypical way, which is to say that I've concluded before inquiring that this group information applies to this patient without even talking to them. And so I can look at my patient who happens to be Asian, and I might recognize that, oh, oops, I shouldn't be looking at this patient. Totally disregarding that perhaps they're trying to like look at me, and perhaps they're getting a sense that, you know what, this doctor's not interested in me because they're not looking at me because of other values that they have. Whereas, and that's using cultural information in a stereotyping way. I've made the conclusion before exploring the option. The option might be, okay, a generalization might be, perhaps, you know, I know some a cultural value in some Asian American cultures where sustained eye contact is seen as intimidating. So what I'm going to do is when I approach this patient, I'm going to be really sensitive to that. So I'll still like reach out with eye contact, but if my patient, you know, kind of averts their eye, I'm not going to say, oh, well, this patient is disengaged. I might then say, well, I wonder if they feel intimidated by sustained eye contact. Maybe I can check it out with them by you know, using other ways of trying to establish rapport other than eye contact. That's an example of a generalization. It's a hypothesis that I come in based on some group information that I've read about, but now I'm going to use, you know, my own reasoning and exploration to figure out whether or not it applies to this individual. And we do this in all aspects of medicine. Patient comes in with chest pain. Do I immediately recommend a cardiac bypass, coronary bypass? No, I don't. I do some tests, I do a physical examination, I take a history because I want to explore that option. It's still on my mind and it's still relevant. I still keep it in mind, I don't ignore it. Which is the other way that sometimes people will deal with cultural information, is that they'll say, I don't want to stereotype, so I'm gonna go in this like a blank slate. that's also not not the best way, because then you can make mistakes that you could potentially avoid. Again, I think about it like chest pain. I come in, I know that the patient has chest pain. I'm going to explore the possibility that it's cardiac origin, but I'm also going to I'm going to keep open the option that it might be something else. That's the balance of the work of physicians, and that's the balance of cultural work as well.
The other question, kind of going way back to your first, you know, coming into an office and maybe not feeling welcomed. So a lot of people that have that experience are just going to leave and never come back, and we'll never know why they didn't come back. So what can we do to prevent that from happening?
Yes, yes. So this is where healthcare professionals...
Or if it does happen, how are you going to... How are you going to access that information? And
yes.
They're gone.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is where healthcare professionals need to be community members. So part of there's a set of standards that are out called the culturally and linguistically appropriate services standards, and they're a national standard that sort of are guidelines that help health clinics, health services do good by cultural work. And so one of the recommendations is to engage communities in building clinics. So it's the responsibility of the healthcare professional to be out in the community to ask about, you know, what are things that help, you know, that you would do to feel more, that you would suggest to feel more welcome in health clinics. It's also engaging other providers who have some cultural knowledge. So perhaps, I'm noticing that there are a lot of patients from the Latino community that just seem to not follow up with me. I might have a colleague who is familiar with working with the Latino community in that setting. And I might ask, you know, are there things that I can do to help to be more welcoming? And it's through these relationships and connections that you build with people that have more cultural familiarity. And then your patients. So, there may be patients who are, you know, willing for various reasons to brave that initial, you know, discomfort, and you're able to establish great relationships with them. Bring them in as well. Ask them, you know, are there things that that I can do to be more welcoming? And you can even make the observation that, you know, one of the things that I would like to do is to be more, of more service to, our Latino patients here. Do you have any suggestions for me that can help me to improve and learn?
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just 20 seconds.
Look, Shortcoat fans, without you, we're nothing. It's true. So we'd like to hear from you, and the more often, the better. If you've got something to say or want to react to a show or give us advice or talk about your cat, we don't care what it is. We just want to hear about it. There are a bunch of ways to tell us. Call us at 347-SHORT-CT or visit our website at theshortcoat.com and leave us a message. We'll read your message on the air, and we'd be super stoked to do it. Thanks for listening.
So we're back. We're here, still here with Dr. Hendry Tong from UC Davis. I happen to know that you were born in Southeast Asia. I think you said that you were born in Southeast Asia. And presumably you have some identification with your patients at the Transcultural Wellness Center there at UC Davis. That must be at many times helpful. Is it also somewhat complicated, though?
Sure. Yes. So this gets into the larger issue of what we call ethnic matching or cultural matching, and the research does suggest that when there's good ethnic or cultural match, that patients tend to stay in treatment longer. But it's the issue is more complicated than that. There are tensions or complexities that can develop when you're working with someone with a shared culture. So, for example, some of my patients, because I'm Vietnamese, and if they're Vietnamese, they may have some expectations, you know. So since you're a Vietnamese doctor, you really understand my situation, so maybe I don't have to go into details about it. And so there's a potential for me to miss critical information because the patient assumes that I know it because I'm Vietnamese. Another example might be where the patient may expect more of me. So we have, for example, we have Hmong clinicians in my clinic, and they work with Hmong elders, and the Hmong people come from Southeast Asia. And there's expectations. So elders expect a lot from the younger generation in ways that my staff don't feel comfortable with. So, you know, can you take my children to school? Can you help me to, you know, to get this need met or that need met? And while it's very important that as healthcare professionals that we really consider the needs and how to address the needs, sometimes it's important to place a boundary so as to foster people's growth. But, you know, my staff have encountered conflict with that because the elders feel like, you know, you should do this because you're a young member of our culture.
It's your job.
It's your job as a youngling in our culture, and not really see the staff member as trained clinicians. So that can cause some challenges. But I think there are also wonderful opportunities where, you know, you can understand where a person is coming from, and from there really help their growth. I had a I'll just quickly tell a story about a patient who I'd seen for quite some time, and then when I departed from that clinic, I asked him a question, and he was Vietnamese and I'm Vietnamese, and I asked him, would you prefer to have a Vietnamese doctor or a doctor who is solely English speaking? And he said, Dr. Tan, the most important thing is for the doctor to understand where I'm coming from and to be willing to listen to me. Now, granted, you're Vietnamese, and so there are things that you understand that I don't need to explain. But Dr. Tan, if you can imagine, and you know this, my life is really bad. Every day I struggle with depression, and I struggle with whether or not, you know, to be alive. And that's, which is one of the challenges, you know, many depressed people encounter. But when I come to your office, I feel like you understand me and you see me as a person. And so if you can imagine a doctor who's closed off to understanding who I am and where I've come from, it's not just that 20-minute interaction that that I feel bad about, but it wipes my hope. The day-to-day struggle that I have, I think about, you know, the people that understand me. And so if a doctor doesn't treat me with dignity, that wipes out that hope, and then I'm left with just the pain of my life. Now, of course, we strive for more, to be more than that, to be more than just a symbol of hope. I mean, we have effective treatment as well that we have to strive for. But in the end, it's still that hope. And for this patient, for example, the hope was really embedded in the sense of, does my doctor truly understand me? And is he or she open to understanding my perspective? And that, I would say, is at the core of culturally humble or culturally responsive work.
I think that's always going to be a challenge in any culture, and the one I guess I most closely is going to be the rural culture. So I'm from rural Iowa, and I've committed to going back to rural Iowa to practice when I'm done, and I think about that a lot. In some ways, I want to do it because I love it. Like, I love the culture there. And other ways, it terrifies me because I know the culture there. And I know that people are going to have those, some people are going to have the expectations of, oh, so you know this stuff. You're from small town Iowa. So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting things to think about with that.
Yeah, I think that what I found to be very helpful in that situation, because I share those anxieties and trepidation as well, is to first allow yourself to have that. I think that some of us, we push it aside and either say, well, I don't want to work with that community, and not really acknowledge that, you know, there are the reasons why we're afraid to work in a community where we share a culture. But the other thing is to recognize that even though we may share, you know, the culture is constantly changing, and every person experiences the culture a little bit differently. And so we call this cultural humility. It's the idea that even though you might have some notions about the culture, the best person to understand the culture is from the patient. And so with that openness, I think, and that humility, I think it's been my experience that it allows you to be less nervous about it because you have an attitude of curiosity and the desire to learn that sort of counterbalances the fears that we may have through our own experiences with our culture. And we all have, many of us have mixed feelings about our cultural experiences. They're not all positive. And the negative aspects may make us trepidatious. But again, looking at it as a constant opportunity to learn more about the people around us, but also about ourselves, helps to, I think, balance that that trepidation.
How do you approach treating somebody with Western medical techniques and treatments? Somebody who is maybe more traditional in their use of medicines, you know, sort of what we in Western medicine, in the Western medical culture, think of it as alternative medicine, to them is just medicine. And so when you go, well, I'd like to give you citalopram. Mm-hmm. For this, and they're like, well, okay, where do I buy the plant? I mean, so how does that work?
So that's a very I think that's the $1 million question. It's very challenging. I look at it from several there are several foundations that help me to manage that. The first thing is to acknowledge, and I acknowledge this to myself, that my brand of medicine, of healing, is just that. It's my brand. You know, if you look at medicine or healing practices across the world, they're very different. Even if you look at biomedicine, which is my brand, our brand of medicine, it's actually quite different in different countries. So it's to understand that my medication has efficacy according to my parameters. Your brand of healing may have credibility according to your standards. I'll give you an example. So in the 1970s and 80s, China was experiencing a significant shortage of biomedical practitioners, physicians. And one of the things that China did was to try to bring in traditional healers into biomedicine and to sort of beef up the workforce. Part of the outcome of that, which I think was a great outcome, was a greater inquiry into the scientific basis of traditional Chinese medicine. But there were some challenges to that. So, for example, I might ask a traditional medicine doctor to, you know, how do you deal with high blood pressure? I have some medications that I use. How do you do it? Number one, there, you know, when a Chinese medicine doctor takes a pulse, for example, there are many, many ways to characterize a pulse, more so than we have in biomedicine. The other thing about the Chinese medicine doctor that I spoke to, how he explained it to me, was why would I treat, so you treat all your high blood pressure patients the same, which is one of the ways in which we study hypertension is we have a control group and we have a treatment group. But the traditional Chinese medicine doctor said that doesn't make sense because everybody is unique. And so you have to tailor, you know, the herbs to every individual. And yet you're doing this very crude, you know, way of like grouping everybody together. But that's how we determine whether or not a treatment works.
It strikes me as a very, you know, Western industrialized nation, you know, send them through the assembly line because we've figured out that this way works best most of the time, you know.
Right. And there's a lot of value to that because with that, we're able to like understand people from a population base. But I bring up this example to say that traditional Chinese medicine may have different parameters, you know, where what we define as, you know, a hypertension, another traditional healer may define as a whole spectrum of different etiologies. So number one, my brand of healing is what I understand most. Your concepts of healing, I need to understand more. So that's number one. And what that does is it helps me to maintain an openness to understanding other traditions. That I think has a role in the therapeutic relationship. When I ask my patients about what they are see as healing practices, they become more open to understanding what I see as healing practice. And so we sort of are able to bridge the gap. Now, there comes a time though that you have to like make a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And that's where it is challenging. fortunately, the body of research on herbal remedies and complementary alternative medicine is growing. And there's a national database that physicians can access to look at the body of evidence of herbs and other remedies for certain conditions, as well as a body of side effects. So there's a there's an algorithm that I will generally use. So there's a class of traditional healing where there's a lot of evidence for efficacy. And with that, I will help the patients to understand that, oh yes, I'm familiar with this from my tradition as well, and this is how I see it working. Then there's a body of evidence that may suggest that the evidence for efficacy is equivocal or non-existent, but also the evidence for safety is good. In which case, I might say, you know, I'm not familiar about how effective this is. In fact, my resources suggest to me that the studies that my colleagues in medicine have done on it, we haven't found how it's been helpful. But I think it's safe to use based on what my colleagues have found. So let's try both. And then there can be medications or traditional remedies where there's a body of evidence that suggests that there are some harmful effects. And so that's my job to let the patients know about that. But a lot of traditional medicine falls into the we don't know one way or the other. And that's where, you know, we engage in a shared decision-making process where I let the patients know about the limitations of my knowledge on this. But I let them know about how important it is for us to have good communication so that if there are problems that come up that I can try to help them sort it out. What, you know, is the side effect from my medication? Is it an interaction? Are there other side effects that we need to look into? So maintaining that open communication. You know, America, Dr. Eisenberg has studied complementary and alternative medicine, and you know, up to 2/3 of Americans use non-biomedical remedies. However, 70% of them don't tell their doctors. And so the first stage of really helping to bring greater awareness to the use of traditional remedies is to ask the question, are there other things in addition to medications that you feel would be important or have been important to you? So just opening that dialogue can do a lot of good.
Do you ever worry though about, you know, about saying, well, I don't really know about this thing that you want to do? Do you ever worry about that diminishing you in the eyes of your patient, or is it just like, well, this is what I have to do? I have mm-hmm. to tell, I have to be honest with you.
Yeah, so the issue of physician credibility is, I think that in the long run, trust is built on honesty. And, perhaps in the short term, the patient may say, oh, the doctor really doesn't know anything about this. But that's probably a good thing for the patient to know the limits of the physician. The other thing is that it helps to acknowledge to our profession that doctors, we can't do it alone. We actually do need help from community advocates, from, you know, our psychology colleagues, from a vast group of healers that we in biomedicine aren't necessarily experts on. Some of that will be, you know, naturopathic healers, homeopathic healers, osteopathic healers. Those healers, I think, are really important as well. I'll give you a very quick example of a patient that asked for a soul calling ceremony. So I had a patient who, and I'm de-identifying their characteristics for confidentiality purposes, but, you know, a patient who had severe post-traumatic stress disorder from horrors in the war and had very significant emotional suffering. I asked him what he thought was the problem, and he said, "My soul is lost." And in his tradition, when a person encounters a particularly horrific experience, their soul becomes disconnected and lost and stuck in that experience or that context. So he had lost his soul.
I have to say, that doesn't sound very outlandish to me. when you
we have metaphors in Western literature that talk about this as well. Mm-hmm. So you know, and I've treated PTSD for many years, and so generally with his level of severity, it would take years of medication, psychotherapy, and psychosocial rehabilitation. And I let him know about that, and he said, "Well, I'd like to start on some medication, but I'd also like to have a soul calling ceremony." So our clinic helped him to connect with, gather resources for a soul calling ceremony. And he experienced a soul calling ceremony. Immediately afterwards, he started to feel better, sooner than what I would predict based on medications. And so, but you know, I decided to wait and watch, and he continued to improve. After about a month, he was doing quite well. After 6 months, he was doing quite well. And I began to question whether or not he needed the medication, whether or not my prognosis was accurate. And I said to him, maybe we should taper off the medication. He said, no, Dr. Tan, let's keep it on. I feel like it's been helpful. And I said, okay. A couple months after that, I was convinced that it wasn't the medication. And I said, you know, I think maybe you don't need to stay on the medication. He goes, well, if you say so, Dr. Tan, but can I still continue to see you? And I said, of course, yes. Off the medication, several months later, came in, was doing really well. At that point, you know, my scientific mind couldn't really explain it. It was more than just the placebo effect at that point. My cultural mind entertained the possibility that perhaps his soul was reconnected. I said to him, you know, I think you're doing really well. It's been almost a year since you had the soul calling ceremony, and you're doing really well. Perhaps you don't need services anymore. And he said, Doctor, I think you're right. I think your medications was helpful. I think the soul calling ceremony was helpful, but I think I don't need help anymore. But can you work with my son? And to me, that was the ultimate compliment, a testament to our relationship and our work together, that it was a collaboration between his culture and my culture of biomedicine, and that in the end, he was willing to try medications, I think in part because I was willing to entertain the possibility that perhaps his soul was lost. And that trust was built to the extent that he was willing to, have his son work with me.
This is a topic that personally I could go on and listening about forever. I mean, it's so fascinating. It's so interesting. But unfortunately, we are out of time. So I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Hendry Tan, for joining us today. Also, I'd like to thank Drs. Nicole Del Castillo and Elizabeth Holman of the UIHC Department of Psychology for arranging this visit today. And finally, Lisa, thank you for joining us. Lisa Greer. Did a great job also.
The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening.
But what I see's a child. Your eyes are glowing red, and your tongue has caught on fire.